Hello, everyone. Can I have everyone's attention? If everyone could please take their seat, and we'll start. Okay, thank you. I'm Gene Lozano, the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation, and to my right, I have Bernice Kandarian, who is the president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. Before I make some opening comments as to what we're going to be doing this morning, I'm just going to ask Bernice if there's anything she may want to comment or make any announcements.
Where's the mic, Gene?
Right here, and there's a glass of water in the way.
Oh, no, you and me in the water. We have watered many of Gene's and Braille notes. Good morning and welcome. And, you know, I think we owe a real big round of appreciation for Gene for getting such dynamic speakers and for getting someone like Lucas Frank, who came clear across the country to talk with us this morning. So thank Gene for that.
Thank you. This morning we have this will be a two-part workshop, I guess you could refer to it. The first part, for the approximately 2 hours less, we're going to have Lucas Frank, who is a senior consultant for new initiatives, to talk to us about a subject that I have heard a lot of people around the state saying is intersections are becoming more complex and more confusing with the new, you know, signals, roundabouts. The turning patterns are changing. Those of us are much older and we were trained, you know, maybe more than 40 years ago. You know, we were dealing with the simple plus intersections, maybe two lanes going either direction, crossed by another road like that, and pretty straightforward. But now there's a lot of turning lanes and so forth. So I asked Lucas to kind of talk upon what's happening to intersections. Also to talk upon the issue that is an idea from the Netherlands and it's spreading around the world, and that is shared public right-of-ways where you have a street with no curbs, no sidewalks, and it's a mixed use of cars, bicyclists, and pedestrians all using the same space and just kind of being, you know, courteous to one another. And there's a lot of different feelings about that. And 2 years ago at this hotel, we had Scott Wheely from the U.S. Access Board who came to get our feedback on this, our reaction. So that's the first part. Then at around 11 o'clock this morning, we're having a presentation on the California Building Code. We've had a lot of questions like, generally, what's the building code? Why do we have it? When it comes to access, and what can we do to get things into the code that makes our environment more accessible in our California Title 24? So we've invited Mike Paravani, who is a commissioner for the California Building Standards Commission, to talk about the process that when the Title 24 goes through the commission. And then Aaron Noble, who is a senior architect for Universal Designs for the Division of State Architect, to talk about the processes when how somebody can introduce an idea to them, how they study it and decide whether to move it on to the Building Standards Commission. And then I'm going to make some comments from having, over the years, done some advocacy in getting some of the access requirements put into the building code. I'm kind of sharing with you some just basic basic general advocacy things that can apply to this process, but to other advocacy you might do, but that I found that worked. Also, that I sit on the Building Standards Commission's Accessibility Code Advisory Committee, and we're one of the steps in reviewing. And I can have some insight from that perspective that I can share when people come and give presentations on why they want certain changes made in the code. So let's start right now, and let's give a hand of applause to Lucas Frank for coming out from New Jersey to talk to us this morning.
Thank you. I think I'll take that mic.
Yes, please.
And move it over this way. Does that work? Yeah. Okay. I just want to say that, first of all, for Gene Lozano to say that he's done some advocacy is kind of like saying like Governor Schwarzenegger has lifted some weight. You know, I mean, it's just so he's a world champion advocate. And I don't know what you people did wrong is my next question. Is, you know, I feel that you must be either gluttons for punishment or you're being punished for something. For be subjecting yourself to 2 hours of talk about environmental advocacy, I don't know what you've done, but you may be in the right. I'd like to just at the beginning say that I think the wrong approach here, especially with a group as small as we are, is for me to talk for 2 hours or an hour and a half and then open it up for questions. I'd like to make it a little bit more interactive than that. And if things get out of control, well, we'll just settle it back down again. But let's start out of control and work back. I want to tell you a little bit about myself. I work for the Seeing Eye. I have for 30 years. Tremendous lack of imagination on my part. Trained dogs and trained blind people for 15 years. At some point, I got my master's in O&M. Going back further, since we have a lot of time, I was born in New York City and grew up in that type of an infrastructure environment, you know, so that I knew street crossings and lots of cars, and I remember the old two-stage lights where you just had red and green, they hadn't invented yellow yet, you know, all that stuff. And after 15 years at the Seeing Eye, I was remoted, which is kind of like promoted only further away, and I was put on the road to troubleshoot. So I would go out to work with someone who had a dog from the Seeing Eye, and they wanted me to come and look at the fact that their dog was jumping on the counter, or the dog was snoring too loudly in meetings, or not snoring loudly enough in meetings, or whatever the problem was. And while I was there, the individual would say to me, you know, geez, while you're here, could you do me a favor? And I had a weird experience at this traffic light the other day, and I don't understand it. Or I'm having trouble at this intersection. Maybe you can figure out what's going on here. And I would go and look at the intersection with them. And sometimes I would be able to explain what was happening, although I didn't quite understand it. I would say, well, you know, there was no left turn movement there this time, but when we came up here, I noticed there were some cars turning left and nothing else was moving, and I don't quite understand this. I don't know what's going on here. Or I would look at an intersection and I'd say, geez, you know, you can do this at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when you're coming home, but if you want to go across to that shopping center on Saturday morning, I don't think you're going to be able to tell when the light's changing in your favor. So, we were all just scratching our heads about this stuff, and I would see this sort of pattern repeat, you know. So I would go to visit somebody, and they would say, you know, well, you know, could you, while you're here, could you just look at this or whatever, or, you know, I think I'm losing my hearing because I went when I know I should have gone, and I just got cut off all of a sudden, you know. And I thought initially that what I was seeing was a series of individual problems, that each individual had a problem in their area. But my job was unusual because I traveled nationally. The Seeing Eye has 1,700 people around the country, so I was as likely to be in Nebraska as I was to be in California when it was legal for us to work in California, or I'd be in Washington State, or then I'd be in Florida, you know, or in Texas. And these experiences began to repeat. Now I'm talking about the time frame. I started at Seeing Eye in 78, so in the early 90s we're talking about now, where this is happening, early mid-90s. And then one trip, I was in Georgia, in Atlanta. And Atlanta is horrendous from an infrastructure point. The South is bad as a rule, but Atlanta is horrendous. And I had three of those experiences in one day. I worked with three separate people, and each of them said to me in turn, while you're here, could you have a look at this intersection with me? And I had three sitting out. You have to understand that I grew up in the Seeing Eye system. I was trained as a dog guide instructor before I was a mobility instructor. And philosophically, you know, dog guide folks are kind of like, yeah, go do it. Go. Get out of here. We don't want to see you. Go. And to be in a situation where I had to professionally say to three people in one day, you know, I don't think you can do this all the time, was jarring to me. It went philosophically against everything that I had grown up believing and thought it. I knew. And I suddenly realized that the world was changing. It wasn't a series of individual problem points, which is what most mobility instructors see and what most blind people see, because most people travel in a limited environment, you know, they teach in a limited environment. You teach in Boise, Idaho, or you teach in Caribou, Maine, or wherever you teach, okay, or wherever you walk. But I was national, so I was all over the place, and I was seeing similar problems cropping up all over the place. And I, in my education as an O&M instructor, let alone in my apprenticeship at the Seeing Eye, I learned an awful lot about ophthalmology and about optometry. I knew my cataract from my glaucoma. Okay, I knew what type of telescopes people should use to look at street signs across the street. But nobody in my entire education said the words traffic and engineering to me in one sentence. I knew what traffic was. I thought I knew what engineering was. I didn't know they ever went together. And so I went to the library. When I got back and I said, who is building these roads? And lo and behold, I found out there was a profession called traffic engineering. And then I thought, well, they must get trained at some university. I'll go look up where they get their training, and I'll go see what's going on. So I found out very quickly that there was not one place where they trained traffic engineers. There were hundreds. Okay, wherever there's an engineering program, there's a civil engineering program. Within that civil engineering program, everybody's taking a traffic engineering course. And there are some places where there are real traffic engineering specialties, and you can get a master's in that and so on and so forth. So I thought, well, where's the closest one to me? And they said it was in Jersey City at a place called the New Jersey Institute of Technology. So I called up those guys and said, hey, can I come talk to you and find out what it is you do and why the heck you do it the way you do? And they said, well, you could, but we're all away this week. And I said, oh, where are you going? They said, Denver. We're going to a conference. I said, a conference of traffic engineers? And they said, oh, yeah. I said, you guys have conferences? And they said, oh, yeah. So, you know, I talked to my boss and I said, you know, we have graduates in Denver. Can I go to Denver and work with some graduates and drop in on this conference while I'm there? And he said, okay. So I did. And not only do they have conferences, but they have really good conferences. I mean, they're big. They have a lot of money. They have a lot. I mean, their food's better than ours. And they're really good at making you go to sleep. If you want to hear a program on how long it takes concrete to dry under various conditions, I tell you what, traffic engineering is the field for you. But I learned a lot. They let me come in for free. I wandered around. They had pedestrian committees. Guess what? I'm at home there. Okay. They had bookshops where you could buy books, and I bought books, and I started to study, and I started to learn stuff. I started to learn. I had figured out a lot of things by that time, but I confirmed what I thought I knew, and learned some things that I didn't know about traffic engineering, and I began to worm myself into the infrastructure. Let me tell you a little bit about traffic engineers. Traffic engineers in the engineering field are known as kind of wacky engineers. People go into traffic engineering who like people. Most engineers don't like people. They like to build things, and they like to figure out electrical currents, and they like to do all kinds of things. They don't really want to deal with people very much. The engineers who like to deal with people go into traffic engineering. Okay. As I said, there are a lot of them. One of the interesting things about traffic engineering and about the relationship of traffic engineers to our field is that we are intimately related to them. If you think about the history of the field of independent mobility in this country, you could make a case for it starting with Morris Frank. Morris Frank. Does everybody here know the name Morris Frank? Just raise your hands or clap or something. There you go. Okay. A lot of people do. Some people don't. Morris Frank was he was from Tennessee, and he was the first American to work an American-trained dog guide. He went to Switzerland in 1928 and got a dog that Dorothy Harrison Eustace, who was an American, and her husband and assistant had trained, and he at Fortunate Fields in Vevey, Switzerland, at her breeding facility. And he came back to the United States in 1928 with Buddy, the first dog guide, and in the U.S. I can put an asterisk next to that, but that's true for all intents and purposes. And crossed West Street in New York, made the papers in a very, very big way, and over the next course of the Buddy's life and his subsequent dog guides, Morris pretty much changed the culture, I think it's safe to say, and changed the perception of blindness in a very, very major way, to the point that there was this was 1928 when he came over. Seeing Eye was founded in 1929. In 1933, there was a movie made called Wings in the Darkness, or Wings in the Dark, with Cary Grant and Myrna Loy, about a pilot who loses his sight suddenly and gets a seeing eye dog. Well, you can get that on Netflix, by the way. It's really fun. If you, those of you who have dogs, I suggest their model of getting a dog. It's a lot easier, a lot cheaper, and a hell of a lot faster. And I'll leave it at that, and you can watch the movie. It's pretty cool. But to have a movie made about a guy getting a seeing eye dog after becoming blind in 1933 is a measure of the impact of the story of Morris Frank hitting the streets with a purebred German Shepherd in 1929. So it had a huge, huge impact. And he was successful. He traveled all over New York and all over the country. Well, guess what, guys? That was made possible by the fact that New York City was filled with traffic lights. That was made possible by the fact that there were so many cars that there were lots of accidents on the streets. Okay? And engineers, being who they are, tried to fix that, and so they invented traffic lights. And it was really only in 1920 that you began to see traffic lights on the street. So if Morris Frank had gone over to Switzerland 10 years earlier, he would have failed. He would have come back to this country and would have been unable to safely cross the streets. The traffic light, by the way, was invented lots of different stories on this. But there's a guy named William Potts who built the sort of first one in Detroit using red, yellow, green. And there was a guy named Garrett Morgan, who was African-American, who actually got the patent for the first light. He was also an engineer. But I think And that coincidence of timing, that Morris landed 10 years after traffic lights were introduced, and the traffic lights were introduced to deal with traffic, and that blind people, beginning, you know, very early on, not with Morris Frank, because I'm sure there were a lot of other people doing it, were able to manipulate the sound of traffic in a very effective way, right? So that people who are blind, as you don't have to tell you, when you're crossing the street, you're using the sound of traffic to align with, you're using the change in the sound of the lights to know when to go, right? And that wasn't really invented by mobility instructors. That was invented by people who were blind, who goes, hey, you know, there's this cool system here. I can figure out when it's safe to cross. I mean, we're all intelligent human beings. You know, you use the tools that are available to you. That's how we survive as a species, you know, and that's how that happened. What was missing at that point in 1920 was an effective mobility tool. You know, there's a lot of film around of people traveling independently in 1920, 25, and they're using short canes and using trailing the edges of sidewalks. The introduction of the long cane in large numbers was the next real evolution in independent mobility for the masses after dog guides. But the ability to travel was predicated upon exploiting the infrastructure that was built by engineers. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. And there's a reason that independent mobility started in the United States and is strongest still in the United States. In other words, there are independent blind people all over the world, in every culture. But in large numbers, the United States leads the way. And that is due to a number of factors, one of which is a lot of independent blind people who are determined because of the American character and sort of the ideals and what we hold valuable, independence, and as it has a high value in our culture. That's not true in a lot of other cultures. In a lot of other cultures, interdependence has a high value. Okay? Where if someone in your family is disabled in any way, the family clan gathers together and takes care of that individual and discourages independence because it would kind of be an insult to the family to do otherwise. Okay? But we don't have that in our culture. We highly value independence. And so that's one of the motivators towards getting people out, and to the reason that the visual impairment and blindness in this country is different from it is in a lot of other places in the world. But another very, very key part is infrastructure. Europe, for example, and many other places, has a very different infrastructure than we have. Their infrastructure is much older. You had a castle, and you had sort of little lanes built up around the castle, you know, within the castle walls, and then outside the castle, and they were all sort of helter-skelter here and there, laid down. You built a house wherever you could. There was maybe one main street, and in Dutch it's called the Hoge Straat, and everything else is scattered off of that. Well, there was no system to that. So you had little narrow streets that turned all which way and the little intersecting alleys off of that, and you had to kind of memorize your way around. Amsterdam is built on three concentric canals. Okay, so it's semicircles going out from a central low. It's harder to get around, okay, when you're dealing with curvy streets. Downtown Boston is tricky because it was built on the ancient model of Europe where you just put streets here and there. Downtown New York City, Greenwich Village, is tricky. It's all screwy. All right, you've got all kinds of streets coming in at odd angles. You go north of 14th Street, okay, and you've got 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st, 22nd, and east to west, you've got 9th Avenue, 8th Avenue, 7th Avenue, 6th Avenue, 5th Avenue, 4th Avenue, 3rd Avenue, you know, and so on and so forth. So you've got a grid. So in the United States, blind people could manipulate that grid. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. And that grid was built by engineers, not traffic engineers, but civic engineers, imposing order on an environment, as opposed to the ancient model of following the environment and building around it. When you get into the Midwest, it becomes, you know, you start to have people really giving you directions, saying, go north till you get to the black and white cow. There's some brown ones in there, but you got to go to the black and white one, and then you need to turn west, okay? And everybody knows what they're talking about. In New York City, nobody gives directions that way. No one says go north and go west, okay? Or in New Jersey, no one gives directions that way. But in the Midwest, you have such regular shaped intersections and roads that people really do give directions that way. And so independence in the United States for blind travelers begins at infrastructure. It was not built for blind people. It was built for cars. Okay? It was built so that cars would not hit each other, so that people could cover large distances safely, so that intersections were controlled in such a way that those cars wouldn't run into each other, going back to 1920. And again, Morris Frank exploited that to all of our advantage, and a lot of blind people following in his path have done the same. So traffic engineering as a field began really in the late 30s and 40s. And I've given talks to traffic engineering groups pointing out the relationship between our fields. Because we are not interdependent, because that would mean they depended on us. But they don't. They don't really know we exist. They do now because we're an annoyance. We're a pebble in their shoe. Okay? But or in their tire, I suppose. But the but we depend on them. And we always have. And the odd thing is that they were invisible to us. We really didn't know as a field, as a community, we didn't recognize that we had a relationship with this group of people that we didn't really know existed. But they do. They're traffic engineers. And they grew up as a specialty around the end of the Second World War. They sort of split off and became a separate subset of civil engineers, traffic engineers. Okay? And they have their own organizations. There's an Institute of Traffic Engineers. There is a... they have their own exams, their own conferences, and so on and so forth. And when we discovered that they existed, and my discovery that they existed was sort of parallel to, I think, Gene's discovery that they existed, and parallel to Janet Barlow's discovery that they existed, we began to have an impact and to interact with them, and to really great effect, I think, as we'll get into a little bit further. The problem now is that where the technology that those guys, and they were mostly guys, now there are a lot more women, there were three at the TRB conference last year. That was 3 out of 10,000, but that's still a 300% increase. No, just kidding. There are more than that. There are actually quite a few women going to traffic engineering now. But I've seen a significant change over the last decade. It's really nice to see. You know, the technology that they developed, we were able to exploit. So straight roads, the traffic lights in those days, in those early days, and there's some older people in the room here, so I'm sure you guys remember that traffic lights used to make a noise at the box that would go clunk when the gears used to change. There was a box on the poles, and there really were gears in there, just big old gears that would go around like clockwork and change. And we could exploit those technologies. We could predict them. You knew that if you were, as Gene was saying, he had a nice plus-shaped intersection, it would go green for one street, then green for the other street, then green for one street, and green for the... And you could exploit that, and it was exactly that exploitation that made Morris Frank's independence possible and so many other people's independence possible. We could exploit the technology. It was understandable at a normal human brain level. Okay? The real changes began to happen in the mid-70s or late 70s, and what we are seeing and what we're going to be talking about for as long as you guys can survive is is the various threats to independence. If that's for me, I'm busy right now. There are a series of threats to our independence that some are all related to technology in one way or another. The first one that I want to talk about is signal changes and changes in signalization. Beginning in 78, roughly, pretty much the same time I came into the field, you really began to see computers hit the streets, and I mean literally hit the streets. When you look at the way intersections are controlled nowadays, when you look at the confusing things that can happen at an intersection in your neighborhood, you are essentially looking at a computer making changes to the lights. So the big change to infrastructure that happened was the impact of computerization and the ability to program computers and make them flexible and responsive to the needs of a particular intersection at the street level. So all of a sudden you have intelligence happening at the intersection level that you can't perceive as clearly because it's doing things that are logical from its perspective, but you can't quite perceive that, as opposed to the old clockwork gears where it just changed and you could perceive that change pretty readily. Does that make sense? Okay. So what happens now is that you get a computer at the corner with sensors built into the streets or watching the streets from overhead. There are multiple ways that this can happen. Typically, one design that is very, very common is called a semi-actuated intersection. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about that. Very, very common. Let's say you have a major street in your area, and you've got a minor street that runs into it, maybe a development road, and there's a light at the corner. Everybody there?
Right.
Okay. That major street, traffic engineers would call an arterial. Okay. And whereas in the old days, the light would change every 30 seconds or maybe once a minute for the side street. That's wasteful if there are no cars on the side street. Okay? So what they do is they put sensors into the side roads. All right, so that a car has to sit on that sensor that notifies the computer that there's a car there, okay, and the light will eventually change for long enough to let that car out. Does that make sense? Okay, but the sensors are only on the side roads because, again, the main road is going to be green all the time. Okay, now the sensors can come in a variety of shapes and sizes. The most common is what's called an induction loop. All right. It doesn't take long to put these sensors in. I used to think they were big metal plates that were in the roadway, and you had to jump up and down on them, you know, and to make the light change if you were a person. I actually did that when I was doing my O&M internship. I did it at Palo Alto, and I used to go in there. I'd see these big old squares, and I'd cut out of the roadway, you know, and I'd go up and jump up and down. My supervisor would laugh at me, but to see if I could make the light change. The reason you can't is that it's not really a pressure plate. If you think about it, you know, how many people thought there were pressure plates where the sensors were? You can raise your hands. That's fine. Okay. Yeah. A lot of people did. There were a bunch of people in the room. Almost more than half the room thought that was true. Okay. First of all, historically, you're correct. Years and years and years ago, the earliest sensors were pressure plates. Okay. But they were bars. They were called pressure bars. They were on springs. And you went over and they went kaboink. And they literally hit a switch that made the light change. That changed a long, long time ago, though. So you're probably just plain wrong. But I'll give you the excuse to say that's what I thought it was. But that's okay. What they went to from there was these induction loops. And it looks like, and your friends and family will tell you, oh, there's a pressure plate there, but there ain't. Okay? What they do is they cut a saw loop into the pavement. They take like a circular saw and cut a groove. Okay? And so it looks like they cut out a big chunk and put a pressure plate underneath there. But it's just a groove. It's about an inch deep. Okay? And they put a wire in there, and they seal the wire with a putty. And the So it looks like they cut a big old chunk out of the sidewalk, put something in there, and put the chunk back in again. And that's why people think there are pressure plates there, but they're not. There's just a wire in the loop, and there's a wire that runs over to a computer, which is a big, you know, what's called a controller cabinet or a big box, okay? And what that loop does is it has a little bit of electrical current running through it, nothing that could shock your dog, for example, but a little bit of electrical current running through it. And when a car passes over that, the metal mass of the car changes the flow of electricity in a measurable way. It's called inductance. That's all I can tell you about it. I've never built one, and I'm not an engineer. But that inductance is measurable, and basically it tells the computer that there's a car there. So to put one of these loops in just takes a day, you know, whereas to put in a big old pressure plate and stuff would take a major construction project. I mean, it's really pretty easy to do. And so when a car runs over one of those loops, the computer knows it's there and it registers it, and it will eventually change the light. Nowadays, you're starting to see those loop systems, which are very, very cheap, very, very effective, but sometimes a little bit fragile, being replaced by video detectors, which use overhead cameras to do exactly the same thing. The camera just stares at a spot on the pavement and looks for cars. Okay? And when a car comes in, it tells the computer that there's a car there. Does that make sense? So sometimes you're not seeing the loops anymore. And what happens there is, you know, whereas in the old days, when the light changed, it changed for whatever time it was set for, 30 seconds, for example, giving you ample time to get across the street. Nowadays, that timing is flexible because, again, traffic engineers are all about efficiency. And if you want to cross, if a car is going to cross a major roadway, that means that that major roadway has to stop, and they want to minimize the amount of time that roadway is stopped because they got to move all those cars. Everybody with me? So what will happen is when the light changes, it changes for just long enough to get that single car out, or if there are two cars, long enough for that. All right, a single car will typically be allocated somewhere between 5 and 7 seconds. Okay, so when the light changes to green for the side street, it will go green for 5 seconds, then a couple seconds yellow, okay, then maybe a second of red in both directions just to allow for red light runners, and then the traffic starts again on the major roadway. Everybody with me? All right. So that's 9 seconds. You may have 4 lanes of street to cross or 6 lanes of street to cross, but you're only going to get 9 seconds to do it if you're next to that car. Does that make sense? Okay. So if you are still operating on the pure basis of go with the beginning of the near side parallel flow and you're crossing major roadways, it's been really nice knowing you.
Yeah.
Okay. If there are 2 or 3 cars there, then more time is added. They'll still allow, let's say, 5 seconds for the first car, but they'll add 2 for the next car because that car's already moving, not starting from a standing stop, so they don't have to give it an equal 5. So they'll go up to a maximum. So let's say you had 10 cars, you get 5 for the first car plus 2 times 9 times 2 or 18 for the other 9 cars. So you get 23 seconds of green time, then a couple seconds of yellow. And back to red, and you're on your way. Yes, sir.
I'm confused by the yellow. Sometimes it seems like it's so short, and other times it's so long, I jam on the brakes, and then the yellow's still there.
What they'll do is they'll have sensors up the roadway, and if they sense another car coming at speed, they'll prolong the yellow. Sometimes. They don't always do that, but they do sometimes. Yeah. Okay. So what happens there again is that if you're a pedestrian crossing that street and you don't push the button, sometimes you'll find you have ample time to get across the street, and sometimes you'll get a sense that everybody's honking at you or whatever. And that's because one time you went with one car, one car at a time you went with 9, one time you had plenty of time to cross the street, another time you didn't. And that's the type of stuff that would happen to me when I was traveling around the country in the mid-90s. People were saying, I don't know what happened, but I always crossed started at the same time. And this time people were honking him, and this guy started rolling at me, you know, was mad at me. And people think they're going crazy or losing their hearing. They're not. They're dealing with a flexible timing intersection. Okay? So what do you do? Well, there's usually, in those types of situations, there's very often a pedestrian push button. What does the pedestrian push button do? I used to think it was a pacifier or that there was a column of water. You know, there was something to do, sort of a game on the corner. You know, you just push this button, which is kind of nice. You know, give you something to do, tiddlywinks or whatever. You know, or I used to think that there was a column of water in there, and if you push the button enough times, the pressure would raise inside. The column of water would go all the way up to the top, ring a bell, and then you could cross the street or something like that, or touch contact. You know, but that's not true. Neither of those things are true. What actually happens is when you push that button, you are putting in a pedestrian call. You are telling that same computer that controls the cars, that controls the timing of that intersection, that there's a pedestrian there. And when that happens, the computer knows to override the minimum car timing with a pedestrian timing. So instead of... Go ahead, ma'am.
For instance, if there's more than one pedestrian, you know how everybody keeps pushing the button. Does it allow for more people to stop?
No, but it keeps everyone busy.
I would put more time on it if it was. If you had more people, if you thought you need more time,
to stop. Yeah. Actually, that's not true. The platoon will pretty much move at the same speed, but there are issues of timing involved here. I'll talk about that in a second for sure. So you get a pedestrian timing. Instead of that 5 seconds for the single car, you get enough time for a pedestrian to cross the street, and that's calculated. What typically happens is when you push the pedestrian button, a call comes in, and when the next time on the cycle comes around for a green, the green will come up, and usually with a visual walk sign, okay, which is now a person walking, okay, which you can, that's a good point, which you can't see, but it's a very nice person. Take my word for it. I'm not quite sure if it's a man or a woman. He's kind of a shadowy stick figure. I think it's purposely ambiguous. But so you have this person, and this walking person, which used to say be a word walk, will be on typically for 7 seconds. Okay. That's by regulation, all right? You must have, you may have as low as 4, but typically 7 seconds of walk time. So we're talking 6 lanes of traffic here. Obviously, 7 seconds is not going to get you across that, right? Okay. But that's safe start time. Then what you get is a flashing red hand, which used to be a flashing don't walk word, okay, but now it's a flashing red or orange hand, okay? And that stays on for a long time. How long? The way they figure this out is they take the width of the street and they calculate a walking speed of 4 feet per second. 4 feet per second is kind of an average walking speed. It's not real fast. It's not as slow as it should be, but it's average. They actually made a mistake in the calculation in the 1950s, but that's what it is. So 4 feet per second, okay? And they divide the width of the street by the speed. So if you had an 80-foot wide street, they would divide that by 4 for 4 feet per second, and they would get 20. Everybody with me? All right. So you'd get 7 seconds of walk time, the walking guy or gal, all right? Then you would get 20 seconds of flashing don't walk time. And it would flash red hand, don't walk, don't walk, don't walk for 20 seconds, at the end of which it would go into a solid red hand for a couple of seconds, and that usually corresponds to the vehicular yellow. And then it goes to that's the end of the display, and you get the traffic starting behind you going the other way. Everybody with me so far? Okay, so the walk indication does not mean that it's only on, the fact that it's only on for 7 seconds does not mean that you only have 7 seconds to cross the street. It's a very common misconception, also among sighted people. So very commonly, you'll be starting at just about the right time, and somebody will say, "It's flashing, don't walk!" Okay? Well, it's okay. As long as you're starting pretty close to the walk, you're gonna be all right. Yes, ma'am?
I live in a really small town. We have, like, one stoplight. And it's a two-lane highway that I have to cross. And unfortunately, when you get that first flash of the walk signal, which only takes me halfway across a two-lane highway, you have turn lanes coming into that walk signal.
Uh-huh.
There is no way that you can get across without either walking in front of a turn of car, whatever possible speed, because the turn only takes up all of your walking time. And if this is about the flashing of a walk, what is the purpose of that? If you feel like there's a walk,
Could everyone hear that question well enough?
Yeah.
Okay. The series of great questions there. First of all, because there is a walk indication does not mean that it's exclusively pedestrian time. Because there is a walk indication does not mean that it is exclusively pedestrian time. You can have conflicting vehicular movements at that time. It can be right turners. It can be left turners. Okay? It just means that that's the time that they've designated as a pedestrian time. Okay? The reason that the way they really screwed up this interface. Okay? It is far from perfect. It is misunderstood by nearly everyone. And it's completely universal and there's no changing it. So there you have it. But that's really true. The reason they don't just have walk all the time until it's ready to change back is because what would happen then is that people might start 1 second before the light was to change the other way, and then we'd really be in trouble. Okay? So the idea of the flashing don't walk is really don't start. You ever see Rain Man? Anybody ever see that? Rain Man's crossing the street and it goes from walk to don't walk and he just stops. He says, okay. All right. So, you know, that's the classic joke. You know, nobody understands the interface. And they have recently made changes to improve the interface, and we'll talk about that a bit too. One of the things that's happening is there is an increase in what's called countdown timers. Everybody ever seen those?
Yeah,
okay. There are countdowns now, and what happens is, and the reason countdowns evolved is because the interface is so screwed up that nobody understood it. And so they were trying to figure out how can we improve this interface, because what would happen is people would, let's say you had an 80-foot wide street, well, they'd see 7 seconds worth of walk, and then it'd start flashing, and it would keep flashing and flashing and flashing and flashing for 20 seconds. So the uninitiated person would just watch this thing going, say, I don't know what the hell's going on, I'm going. And they start going, and they would only have 1 second left, and they'd get caught out there. So they knew for a long time that they had an interface problem. In fact, Washington, D.C. did it differently. They had a walking guy for a few seconds, 4 or 7 seconds, then it would start flashing walk. So instead of flashing don't walk. And so anybody from anywhere else in the country is going, what the heck does that mean? You know? So maybe that's why Washington's so screwed up. Oh, well. But the that's just one of the reasons. But the so what they have now is they have countdowns. And what happens is when the walking guy comes on, usually you'll see the maximum amount of time, let's say 27 seconds come up, and then every second it will count down next to that for 27 down to zero. And the zero corresponds to the vehicular yellow, and then you're on your way. As an attempt to improve the interface. One of the issues with this is, for people with low vision, and this is a Council of Low Vision meeting as well, is that visually, you can't see that countdown clearly. You might see a flashing two flashing oranges, or you would see the white of the walking man and a flashing orange at the same time across the street. And so they're visually confusing. Plus, they use LEDs to do these countdowns, and they're so bright that people are being glared out at night by the brightness of these LEDs. So there are some issues as far as how that interface is improved. But it is improved. I mean, people certainly do understand better. And what you see happening is you see kids looking at a 10, 9 countdown going across the street and say, I can make that. I'm a kid. And you see elderly people going, there's a 10. I know I need more time than that to cross the street. I ain't going. You know, so that you see they've done a lot of studies on this stuff, and it does work. It does improve the interface a great deal. Okay? So, what does that do for people who are blind or visually impaired? Well, what happens is it was recognized a long time ago that there were problems with access to lights by people who are blind. The earliest accessible signals that I know of were at Watertown Square in Boston. Anybody here a Perkins grad? from way back? No? Watertown Square is very close to the Perkins School for the Blind, and there were signals. I've talked to some grads from the 30s, and they tell me about them. But what they did was, Watertown Square is, like you would say, it's a big square. You know, it's a really big area. And they put in bells. Now, nobody could tell what bell was for what street, because there was only one type of bell. So there would be the bell would go off, and you'd be, okay, Hail Mary, full of grace, here we go, bang, and start across the street. And most of them made it, thank God. But but that was really the first accessible signal. And what happened from the 30s really through the 70s was that individual blind people would go to individual traffic engineers in individual towns and say, I can't get across the street. And one or two things would happen. The traffic engineer would look in their closet and say, hey, I got a horn. You want to stick it up there? We'll make it go off at the same time that the... And they'd say, yeah, cool. I don't care. Get me across the street. Or you get a traffic engineer who'd go to the regulatory books and say, I don't see any regulations on this. I'm not protected by insurance, I'm not going to do anything. So you saw sort of ad hoc systems happening all over the country as solutions for individual people. And you saw some men... Yeah, Richard.
I don't want to disrupt your flow, but what are your...
So I don't have a flow.
What are your thoughts on the... I've seen them in Scotland where they had that little thumbnail thing that turned...
The rotating knobs, yeah. They are cool. What Rich is talking about is... there are various types of accessible systems. In England, they have universal placement of pedestrian push buttons, and so there's a little knurled knob underneath the signals you can put your hand on, and next to the chewing gum is this knob that you can that you hold on to and that revolves under your hand. It's very quiet and it works really well in that environment. So they started out with these bells in Watertown Squares, and then klaxon horns all over the place, but no regulation. And that finally changed in the 90s. We were finally able to, working with ACB and with the traffic engineering community, we were able to negotiate some language into the MUTCD. The MUTCD is Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and what that is the book that sort of standardizes what traffic and pedestrian control infrastructure looks like across the country, so you don't end up in Iowa and say, okay, the lights here are purple and pink. I don't know if purple means go or purple means stop, because in the next state over, it's fuchsia and green, you know, or so. So you want to have a sort of universal system, and that's the book that regulates that. But there was no regulation on accessible pedestrian signal until the year 2000, give or take. What was called the Millennium Edition of the MUTCD, which actually came out in 2001, given it's the government. And that allowed and regulated to some extent accessible pedestrian signals, and we've been enhancing that regulation since that time and standardizing and tightening that regulation in every edition of the MUTCD until we're at the point we are now. And the current language on this is not far apart. There's been a ton of research on how to do accessibility. And ACB and the California Council in particular has been very, very helpful in this research. Some of you may remember a study that was done at the ACB conference in Los Angeles in... when was that, Gene? 99. Where we did some surveying of problems that people were having. Again, as I said, nationally there were no standards at this point, but California had a standard. And California's standard was the cuckoo chirps. Okay? And the cuckoo chirp overhead speaker system was effective as far as it went. And one of the reasons it was effective was it was a standard. And Gene and I have had discussions about this. We haven't always agreed, so Gene, you can attack me if you'd like. I don't mind. it was effective, but it was actually an imported Japanese model. Some traffic engineers from Trackinix went over and saw, oh, it's really cool. The Japanese being very, you know, they have these really cool intersections, and they wanted to do something that was not environmentally noisy. Here we had bells and horns and stuff going off all over the place and no standardization. And they thought that birds would be nice, and I think in retrospect they probably would have been better off with a cow sound for north-south and a sheep sound for east-west, because at least they wouldn't be overhead. You know, if you heard a murr from over your head, you wouldn't think, oh, that could be a bird, you know. Whereas we have a problem here with the cheap sound, because you get confused sometimes, at least I know a lot of people who have. But it was a standard, and so the cuckoo for north-south and the chirp for east-west was good. It didn't work nationally for a lot of reasons. For one thing, back in Boston and New York, you had all these wacky angles, and nobody knew whether they were going north, south, east, or west. Okay. For another thing, you had the bird issue, which is real. And our study revealed that people didn't know that all the time. There were problems with it. And in any case, it was a very incomplete interface. If you had to push a pedestrian push button, you had no assistance in that from the overhead cuckoo and chirp. So it was certainly effective. It was certainly more helpful than not. But as a national standard, it had holes. And so you began to see the evolution of a move towards what the current model of accessibility, which includes a move from overhead speakers using cuckoo and chirp, which are still in existence, and you see them all over the place, to a push-button-mounted integrated system. Everybody seen those in some place or not? Anybody not seen them? Okay. Are there any here in Sacramento? Yeah, a lot here in Sacramento. Maybe you can do an accessibility tour for some folks, Gene. I know you've got a little few other things to do, but you know, you never know in your spare time, right? Talk to Gene. are there any near here?
Not really close by here, no.
No, okay. But instead of the old interface had a speaker overhead, the new interface has a speaker right next to you and the push button. Does that make sense so far? And the push button should be located immediately adjacent to your departure point. So that means moving some poles around. And that's one of the weaknesses in the system. It's also one of the strengths in the system, okay? The American structure for pedestrian access of any type was kind of like cars first, followed by God knows what, but wherever the list ended up, there were pedestrians, okay? Cars, trucks, buses, school buses, trains, trams, you know, bicycles, roller skates, skateboards, pedestrians. See, and so what would happen is they would put the pedestrian push buttons somewhere on the corner. California is much better than anywhere else in the country, by the way, in this regard, because California infrastructure is newer. You go to Cleveland, you go to New York City or New York State, anywhere, and there is no standardization whatsoever, and you can never find the push buttons, and you never know which push button controls what street. California is much better in that way, because you tend to have pedestrian push buttons closer to where they're actually useful. But moving to a model where you had to put pedestrian push buttons on poles close to departure points, and that you had sound coming from that pedestrian push button rather than overhead, means that you have quieter notification because it's closer to you. It's more like a headphone than a boombox, if you will. Okay, and you have pedestrian push buttons closer to the departure point, so it's all a well-integrated system. There's been a lot of research done on, also at ACB in LA, that we are looking at locator tones, what the nature of those locator tones should be. We have a national standard now for locator tones set in federal regulation of a once per second repetition rate, so it sounds like a grandfather clock. So, but not a particular tone. So it can sound like that, or it might sound like a. So there are different tones, but that's a locator tone that helps you find the push button and know that it's there. All right. In the most recent evolution of the standards, there is a standardization of what the walk indication should be. It can be speech, as in Millbrae, walk sign is on to cross Millbrae, or it can be a rapid tick. So take that same tick I made before and speed it up 10 times. So a machine gun or a woodpecker type tick, okay, as a walk indication. That walk indication will only be as long as the visual walk indication, 7 seconds. Okay, it will not go much longer than that. Is that clear to everybody? Okay, that does not mean you only have 7 seconds to cross the street, right? So you've got those three stages. You've got the appetizer, which is the walk indication. You've got the main course, which is that 20 seconds or whatever the calculated rate is. Okay, so the walk, audible walk indication will only match the appetizer. Okay, but that doesn't mean you still have the whole main course to get across the street. Plus, you don't want to be in the street until the end of dessert, because that's kind of bad. But, you know, but just realize how they work. All right? Now, let's talk for just a second about countdowns and countdown equivalents. Okay? A lot of people think that because there are visual countdown displays, you have the right to audible out countdown displays. And I can appreciate the rationality of that argument. It breaks down, in my view, in practicalities. All right? And this is an area of great discussion, and I'm going to put my point of view out there, is that I think that we're going to have backlash issues with 30 seconds worth of sound going into the street on every cycle. And I think we're going to create noise pollution issues for ourselves with if you can't hear quiet cars, which is another topic, because you've got countdown displays sounding off all over the place. So I think the lesser of two evils is to have audible information about the beginning of the walk interval and not to ask for equivalence on countdowns. I think it's a mistake. I think it's legally correct but practically incorrect. So that's just my point of view. There's been a lot of movement in accessible pedestrian signals. The Maryland ACB won a case and got a letter from, and I can quote the letter to you. It was Pat Sheehan and Pietrolongo. Pietrolongo, who pushed this through, did a great job, and basically got Federal Highways to say, yeah, you know what, streets are intersections are a federal project. Federal projects should be accessible. Yeah, you need to do accessible signals. So that's added a tremendous impetus to put in accessible signals. Another major victory in California was the San Francisco case that I think you were involved in, Gene, quite a bit, and so. That was won by Laney Feingold and California ACB in a structured negotiation process. And you've got 80 intersections in San Francisco going in with accessible signals. Not all of them done very well, by the way. And I was in San Francisco yesterday or the day before looking at them. And there's some real problems there. And I'm going to come back and do a whole survey, I hope, and give them some feedback. But, you know, it's a significant step forward. It really is. It's a huge, and I think California ACB is to be congratulated, and Gene in particular is to be congratulated on that. Another issue that comes up frequently is how to prioritize intersections. Let's say you're in your town and you've got 50 intersections with traffic lights. How do you prioritize which intersection to do? How does that happen? What are the regulatory schemes? Well, I don't want to go too far in depth in this unless Gene wants me to, but you know, there's a lot of the ground to cover. But one, essentially, there are three ways that signals happen. One is a new construction. So let's say they're building a brand new intersection because there's a development near you that's going in. Well, that intersection should be at least prepared for the infrastructure to accept accessible pedestrian signals. That is to say that the pedestrian push-button pole should be in the right place. Okay. Another way that these things happen is if an intersection is upgraded. Okay, let's say they decide to they put in this stuff in 1978. It's time for a new generation of stuff. Well, when they upgrade the intersection, they should upgrade it to the maximum extent feasible to make it as accessible as possible. And that means putting in accessible signals, or at least putting in the infrastructure for them. And a third way is through an individual request. So if you have an intersection that you find difficult to cross because you can't figure out when the cycle starts and when your phase is to cross the street, you can request that, and the government has to respond to that request. If you do that, okay, what you want to do is you don't want to. First of all, you need to figure out what jurisdiction it is, and that's not always straightforward because you can have a city, a county, or a state. And you can have intersections where a city road crosses a state road or a county road. And so figuring out whose responsibility that light is can be a trick. All right? And then you have to figure out who the traffic engineer is responsible for that. That's not hard. That's a phone call once you figure out who this jurisdiction is. And then you have to begin to communicate with them. And you do that in writing with certified letters. There is language on AER's Division 9 website for a draft letter to a traffic engineer on accessibility so that you can request equal access to the information being presented to your sighted peers. Yes?
Give me the website again.
Yes, it's AER. If you go to the AER website, the AER... ACRBVI, then look under divisions and you'll find division 9, which is O&M, and look under division 9 and you'll find the Environmental Access Committee, and look under the division, the Environmental Access Committee, and you'll find a draft letter. Okay. And you want to document your process because you need to create a paper trail from the get-go on this stuff. Okay. I'd like to but every city, as the city of Sacramento found out recently, should have a transition plan. And that transition plan should include accessible pedestrian signals and should have priorities. How do you figure out where it's most important to do it? What tends to happen is that towns focus on downtown areas, and that's a problem because downtown areas are usually the most accessible parts of cities. It's the periphery, it's the arterials and the side streets that cause problems for people. So, and access to... Go ahead, Gene. Go ahead,
Gene. No, you finish it, I'm going to make a comment.
Okay. The prioritization schemes have a way of coming up with prioritization that involves looking at access to transit, that involves looking at access to major shopping centers, that looks at intersections, which intersections are problematic. Typically, traffic engineers tend to think that the busiest intersections are the most problematic. We know that that's not usually the case. It's often isolated intersections where there's light traffic that causes problems for people. Intermittent traffic, and these prioritization schemes get at that. And there, you can get a hold of these prioritization schemes through me if you need them. You know, and I'll give out my information in a bit. Gene, go ahead.
I just want to comment and agree with you about the ADA transition plan for the public right-of-way. The way the law is written, it just appears that they have to do a transition plan to deal with curb ramps. Sacramento County it's one of the very few communities around the country that actually has an ADA transition plan for the public right-of-way. And we have the accessible pedestrian signals in there, guide strips, other improvements there, and back build on our policy county in 89, we started where any new intersection automatically got equipped with an APS. When they upgraded an existing one, automatically got equipped. And then, of course, on request. And we found after a while that and we had a form, a way of ranking, putting priority on requests, and our practice has gone where all requests are followed up with an evaluation and actually putting them in. We're lucky we have the funding to do that, but the commitment from our Board of Supervisors in this county is that eventually 100% of all the traffic signals that are pedestrians can use that's permissible be equipped with an APS. So that is something, if you Google, and I don't have the website, but Sacramento County, you can find the transition plan there, and that will give you some ideas too.
I'd like to move on a little bit from APS, but there's one other thing that I think is very important to say whenever I talk about these things. Actually, two. One is that paratransit, one criterion for access to paratransit in many locations around the country is that you have barriers to independent travel to get to fixed route transit. And in many places around the country, intersections can be considered a barrier. I'd like to see that go away. And I think it's a great way for counties and municipalities to save money on paratransit. If you take away intersections as barriers to independent access to fixed route travel, that saves a lot of money. But unfortunately, the money to fund APS and the money to fund paratransit come out of different buckets, and so you can't cross those lines. But it would be wonderful if all intersections were accessible, and so that as a criteria went away. The other thing I'd like to say very quickly is how to use an APS. If you are using an APS for the first time, you need to understand what that signal does and what street it controls and be sure of what you're doing. So you might want to locate it, push the button. Often on these devices, if you hold the button down for a second, you'll get some additional information about what street is controlled. The arrow should on the push button should point at the street that is being that you're trying to cross. The face of it should align with the up curb on the other side. And if you hold that button down, it will say wait to cross Milbrae at San Pablo or whatever it is. When the signal goes off, what you do not want to do, whether it's speech or that woodpecker tone, you don't want to jump into the street. As a driver, when a light turns green, I don't floor it because I know there is such a thing as red light runners. Just because I got the light does not mean I floor it. I look and be sure nobody is running the light. You want to think of the sound of the accessible pedestrian signal as on your mark, not go. So when the APS goes off, it's on your mark, check your traffic, then go. Do not jump into the street on the first sound of an APS, or you won't be at next year's ACB. Okay? All right. Several other threats to independent travel in this country. One we've talked about extensively is intersection control changes. What if intersections as we know them go away? And that is happening, and it will happen at an increasing rate. I want to talk about roundabouts. How many people here have dealt with crossings of roundabouts? Anyone? Several, a few people have. Three. Roundabouts are circular intersections. Yes, ma'am. Oh, you weren't sure yet. Okay. Roundabouts are circular intersections. Circular intersections are another very old style of intersection. They go back a long time, but they went through a transition in England in the 70s. They were about to go away because they didn't work. Roundabouts would get jammed up, and they were very unsafe, or circular intersections were very unsafe. And they were about to go away when the British figured out how to do it right, and now they're exploding. Roundabouts used to be these big circles where people could go. It's kind of like the Indianapolis Speedway, and where traffic coming on the circle would have to yield to traffic coming into the circle, and if they didn't feel like it, they had an accident, you know, and so it was terrible. Now roundabouts are much smaller. They're very tight circles, and so the cars have to slow down going around them, and traffic coming into the circle has to yield to traffic going around the circle. And why are they coming? First of all, they're very cheap. Okay. It's a lot cheaper to have an intersection without a light than it is to have an intersection with a light. Because there's no electricity involved. Everybody with me there? Okay. So they're also extraordinarily safe. All right. Fatalities and injuries at roundabouts go drop. An intersection that was taken from a signalized four-way stop, for example, in a rural area, all right, where you had a signal in the middle of nowhere. You take that down and change it to a roundabout, your fatalities drop 90% or more, 95%. Injuries drop likewise. Okay, you get those intersections in the middle of nowhere. You get head-on crashes. You get T-bone crashes at high speeds all over the place. Intersections are dangerous places for cars and pedestrians. So what they found, and there's a ton of research to support this, this is not open to question, is that roundabouts reduce vehicular fatalities and injuries and damage at a tremendous rate. They also reduce pedestrian fatalities and injuries at a high rate. They're not particularly good for bicycles. People get confused and stuff. But it's pretty well set that the intersections... Yes, ma'am.
I'm just
I didn't say that they were accessible.
Okay.
I just said that they statistically reduce fatalities and injuries.
Right. They were showing statistically that they're pretty safe for pedestrians, and that's what caught my ear.
It's true. They are statistically very safe for pedestrians, sighted pedestrians. But I agree with you 100% that, and this is the problem. We have a double whammy here. Okay, what I said, I'll stand by. That does not mean that they are safer for blind pedestrians, nor does it mean that they are accessible per se. Okay, and we have a huge problem on our hands because this is coming our way, and it is going to have an impact on the ability of blind pedestrians to travel safely. Listen, roundabouts. I had an interesting conversation with an independent traveler from New Zealand who was a college professor, and so he went to work in the morning, and on the way he had to cross a roundabout, and he had to cross a signalized intersection, and on his way to work in the morning, it was very, very busy. And he found the roundabout almost impossible to cross, just as you were saying, ma'am, for the reasons you were talking about. On the other hand, he found the signalized intersection quite easy to cross because as at a busy intersection, everything breaks out very cleanly. You know what I mean? This goes, and that goes, and this goes, and that goes. On the way back, and being a college professor, you'd come back at 2 in the afternoon because he worked, but for him, a full day was, 3 hours. But so he would come back, and coming back, he would find the signalized intersection extremely difficult to cross because it was intermediate traffic, intermittent traffic, once in a while a car coming through, and so he couldn't tell the signals. But he would find the roundabout quite easy to cross because it was quite light and there were a lot of gaps. Does that make sense? So there are different problems here, but a busy roundabout can indeed be extremely intimidating. And why? It's difficult because, as you said, everybody's zooming through. There is no incentive to yield when you've got people coming up behind you at speed. People don't, if they do yield, they don't yield for very long. There's been research to indicate that when you have cars yielding, blind pedestrians don't know they're yielding because you can't hear a car that's yielded when you've got traffic moving on the circulating roadway. Is everybody with me? So everything's going around. One guy yields. You can't hear that because everybody's still going around. So what research has shown is that cars yield and blind pedestrians do not take advantage of the yield. And then you get what I call the mama's 5-second rule. Okay. Mama says, be nice to blind people. That lasts for 5 seconds. It's like, God, now I got to get to work. Bang. And they go, And so that what you see, and there's been research done on this by Dave Guth and Richard Long out of Western Michigan University, that you see inordinate delays for blind pedestrians at roundabouts. And what you're really seeing is a measure of intimidation. It's a measure of intimidation. And so, yes, you see pedestrian fatalities drop, but the question is, and injuries drop, but is that because people aren't crossing there? Maybe they're staying home. Maybe they won't use it. You know, and that's the problem with statistical analysis. You don't really know what you're measuring. You know, so the statistics in this sense, we think, are only a partial answer to the question, but at the same time, there's enough indication that they reduce fatalities and damage and injuries that they're going to come. They are going to come. We cannot stop them. Okay. The question is, okay, if we can't stop them, what can we do about them? And there are several issues here. One is orientation. If you're used to coming up to 90-degree intersections, and all of a sudden you come up to a roundabout, you're going to cross and end up at the central island in the middle of this thing, okay, because you have no idea what you're dealing with. This is a landscaping issue to some extent, and making engineers and designers aware of that by putting some kind of barrier surface other than just grass to prevent people from accidentally going out in the wrong place. Another issue is locating the crosswalks, figuring out where the crosswalks are. And this is a problem because, in my view, we don't have adequate language describing what are called tactile ground surface indicators in this country. We have the bumps, the detectable warnings, the truncated domes that you have so often at curb ramps. And that's great. For some people, you know, that's another argument, and we'll get into it in a second, but they're there. But there is nothing to indicate, there's no surface that we could use to put across the sidewalk to indicate that there is a crossing point there. I was involved in a series of committee meetings called PROAC several years ago, and we frankly ran out of time before we could get to this one. But we need a bar tile surface indicator that would allow us to find a sidewalk and say there's a mid-block crossing here, because essentially all pedestrian crossings at roundabouts are mid-block crossings in a way. All right, so you need, we have orientation issues, how to prevent people from going into that central island by mistake. And I know a guy in Springfield, Illinois, who's 70, he'd never seen a roundabout in his life. They put one in an area, a town he went to every now and again, and he spent a long time going to the islands every time he went someplace. He just end up in that central island. Finally, he and his dog figured out he had to go around it. Now they're fine, but I mean, it was terrible. So we have those orientation issues that we need to resolve. Then we have to figure out a way to help pedestrians get across these roundabouts. Now, the Access Board, in their draft guidelines, which came out in 2005, well, the first draft that came out in 2002, they said that they had to have signals at all roundabouts. And the reason they did that was to wake industry up and say, if you're going to import roundabouts from Europe and Australia, you better figure out how to do it into an ADA-sensitive culture and make them accessible, because they're not. And that worked. It got the industry talking about, okay, how do we make these things accessible? In the next edition of the draft guidelines that came out from the Access Board, they said that multiple lane roundabouts, where you have to cross two or more lanes, must have signals. But they did not. They dropped the requirement on single lane roundabouts. There's a lot of research going on right now on this. There's a federal project called NCHRP 3-78, which I'm on the panel of, that is looking at the access to roundabout issue. They're doing research on what are called hawk signals. That research is being done in Golden, Colorado, and looks very promising. Hawk signals are an unusual signal in that there's no signal there unless a pedestrian pushes a push button, and then it starts flashing lights and stuff. They work pretty well. The research is very, very promising there. I'm going to jump ship for just a second and go to another area of research on what are called channelized turn lanes. I'm sure you're all familiar with these, where you come to a corner and you have to cross a right turn lane to get to an island to get across another major roadway. Well, the research on that's being done in 378 on roundabouts is also being done on channelized turn lanes, because in many ways they're similar problems. If you're trying to cross a channelized turn lane, you're dealing with a free-flow intersection that's very much like the issue that you have at roundabouts. You can't tell where those cars are coming from and when they're going to yield. Does everybody get that? Okay. So we kind of figure if we can figure out how to deal with the channelized turn lane issue, maybe we'll get a jump on the roundabout issue. And what we're looking at in channelized turn lanes is surfaces that make noise. So that, for example, a car in a channelized turn lane would be driving over some kind of surface that makes a noise to separate it out from the cars in the main roadway. And that also is showing some preliminary promise as a solution. So it may be that we can do some kind of surface treatment in a roundabout down the line. We're several years away from this. That will allow you to know whether a car is in the roundabout or if it's coming through the turn lane or whatever. So, and that's fairly low cost because, you know, the industry won't do anything if it's going to cost a ton of money to do it. So we have to do it in a way that makes financial sense. So I just wanted to be sure that you understand that I'm not arguing with you that roundabouts are accessible. I know they're not. But the statistics on safety are kind of irrefutable from a global perspective. Do you want to comment back to me on that one?
No,
right.
But the midpoint was always so small. You could physically maybe get either guide off, but maybe I don't have a guide off with me. Maybe a baby stroller in one person, and you cannot meet any of the people in that space. And you'd be stuck there. If other people try to come behind them, didn't know that, they'd be right in traffic and there'd be nowhere to go.
Well, let me just explain that for a second. When you cross at a roundabout, you have an intake lane and an outtake lane. Let's keep it simple and make it a one-lane roundabout, okay? And there's a space in between there. So when you're crossing a roundabout, you're only crossing either an intake or an outtake lane. Does that make sense so far?
Mm-hmm.
So you got a two-way street. They just put a big old island in the middle to separate those two. But those islands, I'm sorry, what's your name, Mel?
My name is Debbie.
What Debbie was just saying is those islands aren't real big. And first of all, they have to be detectable. You have to know you're on an island, and you know what that's like if you dealt with some of the islands out here where they have the cut-throughs. You know, sometimes you don't know you're on an island. That's what they do. So you have to have detectable warnings on them. And sometimes they're so narrow that, you know, if you've got a dog guide or a baby carriage or you happen to be well endowed in the rear, your butt's hanging out there in space. So the... So all of these things are issues and that need to be resolved. Some places have dealt with them, and some of them in England with sort of a Z-shaped crossing at that little median island to provide more space for pedestrians. But these are all issues that need to be resolved. But I don't believe that we're going to get in the way of the roundabout boom. I believe we can change it, but we can't stop it. They're coming, okay? And the one thing I'd like to say is that we are in very good shape because of the work of people like Gene. We are on the front end of these issues. We were able to slow it down. I think without the work of advocates like Gene, like Janet Barlow, like BZ Benson, we would be swamped right now with roundabouts. But we have slowed it down and forced them to look at the access issue because we know it is a huge issue that affects, again, the infrastructure, which affects our ability to travel independently in this country. Two other problems that I'd like to talk about really quickly are quiet cars. Gene asked me to talk a little bit about the shared space movement. I think we all know that quiet cars are an issue. How many people have had negative experiences with quiet cars? Debbie, and you're in the front, ma'am?
Jane.
Mm-hmm. Jane, what was your problem? What happened to you?
I was out going to visit somebody else who sometimes they do a bit of counseling for people who fight it very nice. Was, you know, at an intersection, and just a small, in Ukiah, which is a very small town.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not fear this car at all. and it almost struck me, scared me to death.
Right.
Because it was so extremely quiet. My son also has one, and I've talked to him about it several times, and at first he didn't get the picture. And then he got online and looked up a lot of things and could begin to understand, you know, how dangerous it would be for someone with poor vision.
Yeah.
So that was mine.
And Debbie, what happened to you?
It was basically someone trying to get around in front of me and not wanting to let me walk a little bit to get across all the way. They cut me off and I just got stuck up to the curb.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get hit, but it scared me to death because it was just not possible.
Yeah.
And there was no way that I would have known it was there.
Yeah, they are.
Even if the car has some sound, if you're like the event on Sacramento and it's noisy,
right. Yeah, they and of course all cars are getting quieter, aren't they? But these ultra quiet cars are a real problem, and there's a lot of work being done on this, and this is the one of the areas and one of the few areas where both organizations in the blindness field, and I think everybody agrees that there's a problem. Everybody's working on this. There is a House bill under consideration, H.R.
734.
Okay. H.R. 734 to research these issues. We have to be careful what we come up with in the way of solutions without creating more problems, but there's no question that there is a problem and we need to address it. Go ahead, ma'am.
As we discuss that issue, I always put forth that the kids don't hear the car because whenever you bring up children, it always gets their attention.
I agree with you completely, and I think that as a community, we're going to have a huge problem having an impact on this alone. I've always thought that it's when we start losing kids in numbers that we're going to see progress on this. So if anybody knows anyone who would be willing to sacrifice a child, I would please get in touch with them. I have some children I'd like to suggest as experiments. The issue that I always think that a horse sound should be in there, you know, because one problem really is actually is there's a question of intermittent or consistent sound. If you have horses, at least you got the clop, 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 clop. You can hear them coming, and then as they go into the gallop, you get the. Can you imagine standing at a corner and seeing? Oh, it's a Prius there. But this is going to happen at pretty high speed now, literally, because you're seeing with the gas prices as they were last year, and they'll come back. We all know that. You're going to see a lot more. We're all just worried about Priuses and Hondas now, but you know, once we start seeing a lot of other manufacturers coming out with multiple types of hybrids, it's going to get dicey out there. So we're at the front end of this. You know, we're looking at this and we're trying to have an impact before it explodes, and so that's a tremendous thing. The other area that Gene asked me to talk about are what are called woonerfs, which is a Dutch term which means livable neighborhoods. I happen to speak Dutch, which is an odd thing, but there you go. What's happening is there's a movement for shared spaces and shared streets, so that rather than having clearly delineated pedestrians here, cars there, designs, you sort of have a flat surface where there are no traffic controls for the cars. So it's not like there's stoplights and stop signs. Everybody can go anywhere. Pedestrians can go diagonally or zigzag or jump up and down or whatever they want to do. The idea being that if there are fewer rules, no one feels entitled. So that cars move really slowly at intersections because they have no idea that anyone is someone's coming the other way or not, which is great unless you're under 22. And then you think you're entitled to everything anyway, and you can do 70 anywhere you want. So this is a movement in street design that is happening across the Europe and the U.S. I think to some extent it exists anyway in other sort of underdeveloped areas, you know, where that infrastructure is not as precisely in place and everybody does share those spaces. But you also don't see independent blind people traveling a lot there. So it gets back at what I talked about at the very beginning of this talk, where independent mobility in this country is at such a high level because of the nature of our infrastructure, and we lose that infrastructural integrity, regularity, and predictability at our peril. independence is predicated on infrastructure. And it's all of these various threats that we've been discussing that are a threat to our community. And there's room for activism here, but educated activism. You know, it doesn't do any good to argue against roundabouts per se without recognizing that there are a lot of benefits to them. WoNERFs, these shared space things, I think we can argue against pretty conclusively. The benefits there are much less well proven. It's kind of a style thing. And GDBA UK, which is Guide Dogs for the Blind organization of the United Kingdom, the British Guide Dog School, they only have one, came out with a statement about 2 years ago now, against, strongly arguing against the development of these shared space areas in towns and cities because they're antithetical to the independent travel of blind people. Okay, you combine that with quiet cars, and you've just got a mess.
Because you've got bicycles.
Oh, exactly. So you name it.
And then on top of that, there's a lot of places, and this is very common in the rural areas and industrial areas,
exactly. And that's what happens in these shared space areas is there's no sidewalks. You know, it's like you got buildings on both sides, no sidewalks, no streets. Gene was saying there was a parking meter in the middle of... What was that, Gene?
Yeah, in Portland, Oregon, they had, because there was no curbs, sidewalks, but they had to have places where cars could park, and they had, you know, the parking meter basically in the middle of the flat surface out in the street there, and so you had no idea whether you were supposed to what side of the parking meter you were supposed to walk on, and what side the car would park either. You know, and this was in Portland, Oregon, 2 years ago, and unfortunately, the pedestrian movement, like America Walks and a lot of the Walks groups, support this idea, think it's a great idea, and unfortunately don't fully grasp the idea the blind pedestrians would have a challenge. We have here in Sacramento K Street Mall. And right now, you know, the thought is to revitalize this street is to open it up, that pedestrian mall with light rail, to allow bicyclists and automobiles to go up and down it. And I have been on trying to communicate with the bicycle advocates, and they do not understand it, or, you know, they just say, you know, everyone's going to be courteous and that whole thing, and they don't understand, you know.
No, they're not.
Well, I've also tried to explain to them is that, yes, people could be courteous, but as a blind person, we tend to veer at times unexpectedly, and we may go in a direction and no one's expecting us to go and walk right in front of a car or a bicyclist like that. But that is the direction of more and more communities. The thought is that if you have this additional wheel, automobiles and bicyclists going there, you're going to help stimulate business along these streets and things like that. You know, that is, I really have come to the idea that that is probably the best solution, just getting people receptive to that.
The only way people understand is that they're blindfolded, they're just saying, now walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just like our K Street Mall, if they do it, you'll have cars going across the detectable warnings, destroying them that along the light rail tracks that are warning us, and these things, and years ago, Regional Transit ran small little shuttles there, and that's exactly what they were doing. They were destroying the detectable warnings, and they found another problem. So this is a real concern area.
I'd like to just say one more thing, and then I'm sure you need a break at this point. I could talk on for another 6 or 7 hours, but we're good. The you know, my title is Senior Consultant for New Initiatives, which sounds like I work for myself. I didn't invent the title. It's my sixth one in about 6 years. They don't know what to call me. But I work for the Seeing Eye. And Seeing Eye has been at the forefront of a lot of this advocacy work and has supported me in going to meetings and coming to present in to groups such as yourselves, but also going to traffic engineering meetings and so on and so forth. And I would be extremely remiss if I didn't thank them and ask you to thank them, frankly, for the work that they've done in this area. They've really been on the cutting edge and have a great vision for the problems of providing really good dog guides to people who can't go anywhere because the infrastructure doesn't allow it. So I really appreciate their support, and I'm really glad that they allowed me to come out here and talk to you all. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. If there's maybe, if you know, we could probably entertain one or two questions before we have our next presentation. Anyone have
yes,
one?
I see one in the back.
Go ahead.
This is Donna, and I think one of my concerns, I guess, related to the accessible pedestrian signal, and yes, I very much support of them. But one of my concerns is, you know, in certain places there seems to be slow to the signals that, you know, and, you know, our birds in the environment are getting very resourceful, and they are mimicking sounds.
Yeah, that's very true.
And so I'm curious to know if there's anything in the making that would have, you know, the combination vibrating, talking, and or something else, because as I said, these birds are very resourceful.
We've taken on this issue at the Seeing Eye, and we're beginning a new bird training program. go ahead. Gene, you want to talk to
them? Yeah. Donna, I think you're going to find within the next few years that the bird sounds are going to be totally gone. What we found when some of the research that was done in San Francisco for the structure negotiation was the rapid ticking sound being the most effective, which is, I believe, what they use in Australia and some of the other countries. And it seems to be more effective than the bird calls or even the messages with a human voice that cannot always be understood because of wind and also the quality of the digital voice. So I think you're going to find that going. What's the advantage is that as communities get the digital APSs, they can then change the sounds. Where the old analogs, like Sacramento County, the vast majority of them we have, the overhead analogs, I mean, it's just the bird calls and you can't change it.
But is there a way to do because we have folks in the community who like the rapid ticking. We have other folks in the community who aren't quite able to hear that and they're able to respond to the speaking. So, you know, I was just curious if there's a way to continue to keep both because I understand the need for both and I don't want one segment of the community.
There's actually research that shows that speaking is not that effective.
That's right.
There's a lot of problems with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can see that. I can definitely see that, but from what I've heard, and no, I'm not a researcher, and no, I'm not a good statistician, but in dealing with some of the seniors in the local area and other groups, you know, within the area as well, you know, it's kind of sound and the talking is what folks are saying, if that's possible.
it is doable. You know, the nice thing about digital is that anything is doable. Gene's point is well taken, that there has been quite a bit of research on this. The research has shown that you're quite correct, that the bird calls are insufficient in a lot of different ways. The research has also shown that speech is problematic for a lot of reasons. Although there are standards in the federal regs for speech, there are certain situations where you can only do speech. Mm-hmm. All right. Let me give you an example. I see your hand back there, ma'am. I'll get to you. In most situations, the way the current recommended designs are, you should have two signals on one corner. So imagine a big old wide corner, okay? You've got one pole over there next to one crosswalk away from the center of the intersection, okay? And you've got another one way over around the corner aligned for the other crosswalk. Are you with me? So you would have, and the way the regs are written, you would have a rapid, so if you were waiting to cross street A, you would push the button to cross street A. If you wanted to know for sure that was the right one, you might hold the button down and it would say, this signal is for street A. And when it went off, it would make a rapid tick, a woodpecker tick, 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 okay? If you were waiting there to cross street A and you heard one from back behind you on your left, for example, you would say to yourself, oh, that's the one for street B. That's not mine, because mine is going to come from this push button right next to me that I pushed. That's not coming from this area. Are you with me so far? Okay. So what you have is you have notification by proximity. The one closest to you is the one that's going to go off, okay? However, in some situations, you can't do that. There isn't enough real estate to separate the signals by enough. So you might have to put both signals on one pole, all right, because it's just a narrow corner. Well, in that situation, if you were to use the same sound, you would never know what street was which, okay? If you were to use the cuckoo chirp, you would have exactly the same problem we have now, where people don't always know what street's being served, okay? And so the best way to do that is speech. And there is regulatory language and recommendations coming up. Well, there's regulatory language now, and there's the improved language, which will come out in the 2010, I think, edition of the MUTCD, which gives very specific language on how to give that information through speech. If you don't use speech where you have two signals on one pole, you have unacceptable ambiguity. Okay? So in those situations, what it will say is Millbrae, walk sign is on to cross Millbrae, or San Pablo, walk sign is on to cross San Pablo. Okay? That's the way that language will be structured. Sorry, I beg your pardon?
There's still ambiguity unless you know the names of the signals.
True enough, and that's resolved by the arrow pushing at the street. If you hold that button down, I've watched people actually put the whole thing together, know which one is which. It does work. Not for everybody. Nothing works for everybody, but it works for most people. I have seen signals that do what you suggest, which combine speech with the old-fashioned cuckoo. I've seen it done. It has not seemed impossible to me. It is not standard according to the way the regs are written. Now, the regs call for the rapid tick. I don't know that the regs exclude the use of a cuckoo in addition to that, or a chirp in addition to that.
So discourage
it, but don't, you know.
Your rapid tick sounds a lot better than the chirp and cuckoo.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is
I've seen that too. I've seen that apply, and I think, yeah, I've seen that also. The problem with the speech, there are several problems with the speech. One is intelligibility. If you've ever had a conversation on a noisy corner, you know what I'm talking about. If you ever tried to stand on a corner and have a decent conversation, you can't. You know, it's just loud. So that's one of the rapid tick sound tends to penetrate better. In my view, the Australian signal's even better yet, but, you know, we'll see where we get to in time. So, does that help?
Yeah, I think one more question and then we have to stop.
Yes, ma'am, you're in the back. Yeah, I saw you before.
How many states and countries have pedestrian-level bicycles? In Thailand, you want to be on the other side of the street, you need to be more.
Well, there's always some level of pedestrian protection, but, you know, you're certainly one of the best, and you're certainly one of the highest compliance rates with pedestrians, but it's dropping. I mean, every time I come out here, I see it deteriorate. And you bring in too many people from other states. You ought to make your weather worse or something, or have more earthquakes. But I don't believe that depending upon pedestrian right-of-way is really the way to go. I think it's a good additional protection, but I think you need to have some solid information about when it's safe to cross. Yes, sir, in the back. Well, if they're going to get hit, I hope they get hit by quiet cars so we can get dual use out of them anyway.
Lucas, I'm going to ask just, maybe just ask you the last question, and that is, do you know whether the research on APSs, are we getting any closer to maybe coming up with a real definitive walk announcement, whether it's a rapid tick or something? I mean, the thing is, you know, like San Francisco has the rapid tick. A lot of the adjacent communities surrounding San Francisco have still the cuckoos and chirps. And there's some places in the peninsula south of San Francisco that have some of them that have the speech. And the thing is, we need to get something consistent and predictable so that you travel from one community to another community. When you hear that sound, you know what it is, just like we have the red, green, and yellow lights there. And that's something I just wonder if we're coming to something closer that we could come up with a national standard that this XYZ sound is the one sound that will be used universally throughout our community. Do you know if we're getting anywhere close to that?
Yeah, we're really pretty close to it now, actually, and the split is still there. There is in effect a national standard with the rapid tick rapid tick or voice speech. One of the issues is in California specifically. California had the highest percentage and the highest number in either way you look at it of accessible signals before the year 2000, and also since the year 2000. There are more accessible signals in California than there are in any other state, or probably in all states combined in the U.S. That's because of the nature of your infrastructure, I think, and probably also because of advocacy, and possibly also because Traconex was a California company. But you have a lot of accessible signals here, and that means you have a grandfather problem in that you have a lot of older infrastructure. For example, the city of Oakland, which I'm sure many of you know, has accessible signals of the old cuckoo chirp style with all the attendant problems of that all over the downtown area. And they're just not about to swap those out. And there's no grandfathering provision that I know of even being discussed in terms of well, let's get rid of the old cuckoo chirps and swap them out for these guys. I don't anticipate that either. I don't know, but I don't know. But that's really a California-specific problem because you have so many. And I'm very glad of. So I think for a while, I believe you're just going to have to live with that one.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you very much, Lucas, for coming to California and CNI, and we very much appreciate it. And I don't know whether you know what your schedule's like, but if anyone has any questions, can they ask you maybe outside the room for a few minutes? Of course, you're welcome to stay and hear our remainder of the presentation. But again, we know that you're on the clock too for CNI and have to see clients too.
Right.
So you're welcome to stay, but thank you very much. Okay. Well, that's at 4:15 this afternoon. Okay. Yes, that's my understanding. Yes. Okay. Next thing, do we have our Mike and Aaron?
Yes.
Okay. So, would you two like to come up? Okay, Lucas. Again, Switching gears right now, we're going to be talking a little bit about the California Building Code that has some provisions to do with access for persons with disabilities. And in there, we do have, as we refer quite often to Title 24, we have some provisions for the blind and visually impaired, stair striping, detectable warnings, warning curbs. Okay. Warning curbs. The thing is, and signage and so forth. I have been asked repeatedly, "Is like, well, how do these things? How do these provisions get into the building code? And how can I come up with an idea as an individual to try to introduce something?" So what? Decided to do was to invite first one of our regulatory agencies here in California that puts together access requirements in Title 24, the Division of State Architect. And then, so they could talk about the process if somebody was to introduce it, because they probably get the greatest number of requests for changes to the build amendments and changes to the code. And they can tell the process of what you have to go through internally. And then the next step is that after the Division of State Architect for this case decides to submit some amendments to the California Building Standards Commission, they have a process for public comments and so forth, and eventually it goes to their commissioners. And so we also have invited a representative from the commission to be here to talk about that process. I am going to, at the end, give a little bit from the advocacy perspective of some experiences I've had in introducing amendments and giving you an idea of what seems to have worked and what hasn't worked and so forth. So to start off right now, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Aaron Noble, who is a senior architect for the Office of Universal Design under the Division of State Architect, who will talk about DSA's process of how accepting formal and informal requests for amendments. Aaron, thank you.
Good morning, almost afternoon, I guess. I'm Aaron Noble with the State Architect's Office. I work directly for the State Architect in DSA headquarters. As Gene indicated, pretty much anybody can submit a proposed code change to DSA. Typically, we develop the regulations and amendments for the building code as it relates to buildings and facilities that are contained in primarily Chapter 11B in the building code. And often we will get proposed code changes. They don't necessarily have to be specifically code writing. It can just be someone proposing something in general, and then if it's considered, it could be rewritten, and we have staff in our office that can do that. There is a process by which proposed code changes have to be evaluated, and there's a 9-point criteria in law that the proposed code changes have to follow. A couple of them, for instance, are that they can't duplicate language that's there, and also another point is that they have to be clear and concise. People can understand them. Second to that is a requirement that was passed in law in the year 2000 that restricts the state architect's amendments to those that do not enhance or diminish except to meet the ADA requirements. So we've viewed that, as our legal counsel has, being somewhat confining and narrowing our ability in order to propose code changes. The proposed change has to be also analyzed under that criteria. And in some cases, proposed code changes have had to be rejected because of that. So, first, when we receive the proposed code change, we would look at it to see, is this an enhancement or actually a diminishment, too, as to what the ADA has as far as their design standards. And DSA has accessibility committee that is under the DSA advisory board that meets several times a year. I think they probably meet four or five times a year. And in fact, they're meeting next week for a two-day meeting in Sacramento at 1102 Q Street on the fifth floor. And that's our accessibility committee. And that committee meeting is open to the general public. Anyone can attend that. The committee's meeting this next week is looking at the proposed code changes for the 2009 rulemaking cycle that will become the 2010 California Building Code. I've got to keep all these numbers straight. It's difficult. And so that's actually occurring next week, and I'm sure they'll be meeting again over the summer. And the committee basically reviews the code changes, provides comment, and then forwards their recommendations to the DSA advisory board. The advisory board also reviews the committee's recommendations and then makes a recommendation to the state architect. The state architect is appointed by the governor. From that point, then we take the recommendations of the committee and consider those. There's no obligation on DSA to incorporate the committee's comments, but they certainly can at DSA's discretion. And at that point, then what happens is the proposed code changes, however they get somewhat tweaked, ends up going to the Building Standards Commission. The Building Standards Commission usually sets a deadline for all the state agencies. We're only one of several. There's the State Fire Marshal, there's Housing and Community Development, and there's Office of Statewide Health Planning, and all the different state agencies have promulgation of regulatory code for building standards that's set out in law. So when that deadline is set by the commission, then we generate a code package that is what we call express terms. And these are the express terms expressly indicating what we're going forward with for regulatory changes to the building code. And also we have a statement of reasons that goes along with that, and that gives our reasoning for proposing the proposed code change. And at that point, what happens is it enters the commission's rulemaking obligation. And we're still involved along that process, which actually can take up to 6 months. And we're involved in that process. But at that point, it becomes the commission's rulemaking on behalf of the state agencies. And ultimately, at the end, the commission either approves, disapproves, or further studies a particular item, depending. So, for the most part, that pretty much wraps up our process. Again, it's an open process. We have public meetings that are open to the public. They're noticed 10 days prior, like any other public meeting is required to be. And any person can propose a code change. That's part of the open government process. So anyway, that probably concludes what I have. Would you like Mike to pick up? Okay.
Okay. I don't think we have a long enough leash to use.
Well, we might have a little bit under there.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, I pulled an extra foot.
Hey, thank you.
Carter Bonnet, who is a commissioner from the California Building Standards Commission. I hope you can hear me. So I was going to kind of give you a perspective from when DSA submits their package to what happens to it at that point.
What is DSA?
Division of State Architect. Mike has the mic.
Oh, okay. Here's a handheld mic, Gene, if you want.
There you go.
If you want. Okay. After receiving the input from DSA, the commission staff begins to work up the proposals. And what happens is that about 10 days or maybe 2 weeks before a commission meeting, this thick binder lands on my doorstep at home with a resounding thud. And what that is it's sort of a roadmap for the meeting. And we have a meeting about every other month. And the binder will contain an agenda, and it will contain folders that deal with each of the items that will be taken up by the commission. The commission is an 11-member body appointed by the governor, and there are a variety of disciplines that are represented and interests that are represented on the commission. Fire is represented, engineering is represented, contractors, members of the public, building officials, and I am the member that speaks for Californians with disabilities. And we go through the binder, and we find that there'll be an executive summary for each item that is going to be heard by the commission, which will talk about the background of the item, including its subject, and it talks about what actions the commission may take. And again, it gets back to the items that Aaron was talking about in terms of adopt and approve, or adopt as amended, or reject, or return for further study. One of the things that I think becomes a real misconception is what kinds of action a commission may take when these items are heard. And actually, the authority we have to act is on a very narrow base. We can only respond to the language that has been brought through the process and vetted with the public and heard. And so, for example, let's suppose we're talking about an issue where stair striping is before the commission. We may well receive input from the public saying, can you deal with tread depth? Well, no, we cannot. We can only deal with the stair striping issue that has been brought through the process. And what I'm learning as I go through this is that that's a real significant misunderstanding in the public, because they think that the commission, when we meet and we're looking at an issue, has an ability to act in a very broad fashion. The other thing that we can't do is we can't expand beyond and change scoping and those kinds of things that would materially change the proposal that's before us. Again, we can accept it, we can send it back, we can reject it, and the ability to modify from the dais within a commission meeting is very limited. So when we're looking at these items, we're looking at the input the public has brought, and that is summarized in the commission packet. And DSA's response to that input is stated in the packet. And at the meetings, at the commission meetings, we also have occasion, and obviously this is going to depend on the nature of the item being considered, we have at times very extensive input and public testimony. And the commission meetings are available through internet. You can go to the California Building Standards Commission.gov and see the meetings and call in and provide input on items that you may be concerned about. And when we've heard the input, when we've looked at the packet, when we've looked at what letters may have been submitted to the commission on behalf of individuals throughout the state, then we begin to look at what kinds of actions we're going to take. And that is how, ladies and gentlemen, the code becomes what it is. And one of the things that I think we need to think about is that I think in the ideal, we would have a code that would be clear, non-ambiguous, and easy to understand and implement. That may not happen in the lifetimes of our grandchildren. It is a complex beast, and frequently when you're looking at the action that goes into modifying or putting the code in place, you see competing interests and competing levels of understanding of something like the impact of the environment on a person with a disability who's trying to use the environment. And sometimes I found myself at odds with some of my fellow commissioners, being the voice, the single vote for people with disabilities does not necessarily mean that if I make a motion and want to move in a given direction that I'll prevail. And that is the reality of the situation. Any questions? Yes, way in the back. That's correct. And it's a the question is how was I chosen? Yeah. You essentially, it's a position you apply for, and then you look at obtaining letters of support, in my case, from organizations that address the needs of people with disabilities. And I was interviewed in the governor's office by the agency secretary and some members of the governor's staff. Pardon me? I didn't campaign for. I'm pretty apolitical when it comes to that stuff, and so I didn't. I didn't campaign for the governor. Yes, I think it's people that have a sincere interest in seeing the code perfected as much as it's going to be. People come to the table with different expertise and different passions. One of the things that the commission has done of late is done a lot of work in developing a green code. And there's people there that really have a passion for that, and that's what they bring to the table. That's different than the background that I bring from the table to the table. So the commission, by its very nature, is going to be quite varied in some of the issues that we deal with are engineering issues which don't bode well, quite frankly, with my background as a rehabilitation counselor and ADA coordinator. So, I mean, you know, we're all bringing these different perspectives, and hopefully each one of the 11 of us can help bring our fellow commissioners along in terms of understanding what we perceive as the best thing to do with the various code violation or various code proposals we see. Yes, ma'am.
It's my understanding that West Chesswell from Mendocino County is heading a board that will work with people with disabilities in the Northwest.
I know of him, and I've heard that he's been appointed to an assembly committee to deal with people with disabilities, and I know that that appointment is very new, and so I don't know exactly how the activities around that committee will unfold. Quite frankly, I feel encouraged that action is being taken, because I think there are a number of issues on a variety of areas that the voice of and concerns of people with disabilities need to be brought into the light.
Yeah, he's a wonderful person, and he'll just do great things for us. I know he will. His wife has multiple sclerosis, so he knows about this.
I didn't know that fact. I knew that he had a really strong track record.
He was term limited, and then he's gone in for this new position because that's what else is open. And I hope he works up again, because he's just wonderful. He's a lovely man. That's what you do. Would you be working with him?
I don't know that we'd come into contact. I'm certainly not opposed to it.
Maybe to generate some more questions, perhaps I can talk on the from the other side, the advocates. What you really need to do is. You really, when you come up with an idea of something you want done, is really think it through as to what is it that you want, and then to identify what regulatory body, whether it's Division of State Architect or Housing Community Development or Fire Marshal, that has the authority that would address the issue. Then it's putting in, preferably in writing, is your request that what you want, and being very clear and concise, and then substantiated with documentation that will support the position, especially if there's research that would support it. I know that I was told back in the mid-90s, the head of the area, DSA was the Office of State Architect, Judd Boyce was the head, and he told me that probably the most, at that time, studied and information they had on any access thing was detectable warnings. They had just been overwhelmed with research, and when the federal government had suspended detectable warnings, California decided not to take that position of suspending detectable warnings. They were convinced, because there were so much scientific studies that we had submitted, to look at that and came up with a compromise on the detectable warnings, that there were certain sloped surfaces would have this the detectable warnings, gradual slopes, and those that were steeper would not have it. But that is something that really helps substantiate. It's not an opinion. You have something that you can point to. That also helps staff and that agency to do further research, to look into it, and because they have to cite documentation that is just, again, not in a personal opinion. The thing that really worked back for improving the code in 2001 was that there was the networking of competing stakeholders that generally would not support one another's positions got together, actually had space that was let to us. The Division of State Architect let us use their conference room, and we met some of the leaders from the disability community as well as from the private sector. For instance, the Hotel and Motel Association, the Building Owners Management Association, and we worked out are and identified those issues that we had common grounds, maybe for different reasons that we were in support of it, but the outcome was we wanted the same thing. And we then, after we had settled these things, as a body submitted to Division State Architect, proposed amendments with all of us agreeing it, and DSA decided that these they could support and could forward on to the Building Standards Commission. And it went through the public hearings, multiple public hearings, and written comment periods that the Building Standards Commission conducted. And when it finally got to the commissioners, we hardly had any opposition from the commissioners objecting to things, because we had the competing stakeholders had worked out their differences beforehand and went to them and did not put these people, commissioners, in an awkward position, because, like it was implied earlier, it does get political at times. Some of the people are looking at what impact is it going to have on the industry they represent, and it's going to be a financial hardship. Is this something that they can buy into immediately or not at all? And so we resolved these things ahead of time, and it made it easier for the commissioners to go ahead and accept it. So networking is really critical, not just with people within the disability community, but looking at outside of it, other stakeholders that maybe would not support your items, and see if you can find common grounds. The other thing is that whenever you're talking to the staff or the regulatory persons, or as well as elected officials, always be truthful to them. You got to develop trust, so that if they reach out to you at times, maybe you don't have something out there you want to forward, but they are interested in getting some input. They know that you're going to be truthful, and you're going to give them the exact facts and not mislead them. So you got to have established trust, and that means you have to be flexible, and it's hard at times, but you got to be flexible. Sometimes you got to change your position, and maybe you can't get the whole amendment that you want at one time, but maybe taking one portion of it and championing it through, and then coming back to the next code cycle for the next part that you can do it in piecemeal. But that might be the only way. You have to be sometimes flexible in that. And also, you can't threaten, and that's, I've seen sometimes where the advocates have gone before the commission or even to the public hearings and said, you know, if you really don't do this, we're going to go the legal way and we'll sue you or something like that. Purely emotional, and you've lost your battle before you even started. So that's just some advice I'd like to give, and let's see if there's any further questions for Aaron or Michael. Go ahead.
Where can one find the actual procedures for the course committee? Is there a how-to on the website?
You'd have that.
The procedures for rulemaking are outlined in what's called the APA. That's Administrative Procedures Act. And that is a, I guess, what you would call a grouping of the regulations that are contained in California law that establish the process of rulemaking. It primarily, I guess, is a protective procedures, in that the development of regulations is done in an open public forum. and there's noticing requirements, several points of rulemaking requirements, but it is the Administrative Procedures Act that governs the state agencies. I believe the commission is under their own separate building standards law as far as their processes go. I think they may be repeated in the APA for the Building Standards Commission, but I don't know. Michael, did you want to add anything?
No, okay. I think it's, questions, too, can be directed toward the commission staff, and you can get contact information, again, on the website. If you have specific issues that you're trying to look at, sometimes, you get into meetings like this, and some of the responses we give are a little global, and then you sit down with a specific kind of situation you're looking at, and you say, well, what do I do with this? So, feel free to give the office a call.
Also, to add to that, each of the state agencies, like the Division of State Architect, on their website has their process, how you can submit something to them. DSA has one, and their process is different from Housing and Community Development, so it's going to the individual websites of those agencies, and then you can find the guidelines on
I think another important thing to watch is the comment periods where something is being proposed and it may be going through the process. It may be something that you did not initiate, but you may have an interest in it and you may want your insights into that proposed rulemaking heard. And so you'd be watching the process for those comment periods to get your input in the process. And again, as you do that, one of the things that I would strongly urge you to do is to really keep your comments focused very tightly on exactly what is being considered, and not try to broaden it beyond something that may be closely related to what's being considered. You may have an issue that's closely related that we're not going to be able to deal with because we haven't gone through the process with that, and that may be something that stimulates a proposal that you may want to make independently down the road. The other thing that comes to mind too, and sir, I'll get to your question, back, is the whole thing of I think it's important for the commission and everybody that's working on these proposals to know the impact of the environment on a person with a disability. And one of the things that I see myself doing sometimes with other commissioners is talking about this is the impact of this proposal on a person attempting to utilize this environment. So we need to always be thinking about that as an educational effort. Yes, in the back. Voluntary. The travel expenses are paid. That's it. The terms are, I know my term expires at the end of 2010. I think there are 4-year terms, 2-year, something like that. Pardon me? No, they're staggered. And all that's on the webpage, too. You can see each one of the commissioners in terms of when they started, how long their term lasts, and what background they bring to the commission.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, then, I hope this kind of gave you a flavor of what it's like to go through the amending of the building code. It's very complex, but still, if there's an issue, this is something you can still, as an individual, take before the group. Also, internally with the organization, if there's some access thing that you'd like to see changed, you can submit it to the Committee on Access and Transportation, and it's something we can in review and make a recommendation that if it's something that consistent with our positions, go ahead and introduce it through the process, whether it's through DSA or some other state agency. So,
and as a word of warning or hoping to set a realistic expectation, just please keep in mind that this is government and government is not built for speed. So it takes time.
It takes time, and not everything that goes is brought to them is going to go through. There's multiple levels that it has to go through, and it can be stopped dead in the water anywhere along that process. But I can tell you, when it does get through, and if it's adopted by the commission, it's a really high that you get. It's just the satisfaction. You can see that the change has been made. But as a group, we've done that, and there's people in this room that have given testimony and made the difference on getting things through. I wish to... Yes, is there a question? The destination-based elevators?
Work in progress.
That was went to the December 18th of last year. The DSA advisory committee that I have a seat on recommended that DSA look at this matter, and I'm under the impression, correct me, Aaron, that this is goes to the DSA's advisory board in May to see if they concur whether there's merit to the recommendation that DSA work on this.
I know the committee was looking at the destination elevator issue. I'm not totally sure exactly where it is at this point. It may be going to the advisory board, the recommendation of the committee to the advisory board at their next meeting. I think that's where it is. I think you're correct.
And that would be in May, and then the advisory board, I believe, makes their recommendation to the state architect. And if they feel that there's, and the state architect feels that this needs to be looked at, then they would start the process of convening meetings and working on language. I'm assuming, I'm speaking just for myself, that probably recommendation would go forward. The elevator industry is very eager to get this into the state building code. They have a lot of political clout, and it's also the advocates want this too. So I feel hopeful that we'll see something starting sometime this year.
Jane?
Yes.
Jane Carnes. I had an opportunity to try the one in New York City,
mm-hmm.
right near Times Square.
Right.
And it looked, I think it worked out pretty well. Ken happened to grab some fellow who was with his wife and child in a stroller to try to help us. And as it turned out, he was an engineer, not in this mode of engineering, but Ken could see a little bit. With my vision, I couldn't quite grasp it. You know, it would say what elevator number mm-hmm. would have said, you'll find that elevator behind you or to the right or to the left or a second elevator down. It would have really been helpful because I found it confusing.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are the things that if the recommendation is if it's implemented, the recommendation, then work would be done, the drafting language, to have statewide standards so that it wouldn't be different communities like San Francisco who's spearheaded those efforts to see that something be started on the state level and nationally. So,
can you have one more question to that?
Go ahead.
Do we have a microphone?
No, we don't have a cordless.
Okay.
This is addressed to you as well. I saw a little thing on Channel 3 KCRA yesterday. Actually, it's Channel 13 on the rebuilding of Terminal B with regard to the safety and maintainability of the terminal with regard to that is concerned. Is there anything that you can say anything as far as the building, as far as with regard to people with disabilities? What can they expect when the new terminal is built at Sacramento International Airport?
Okay. I guess it's a project under the county of Sacramento. I have I'm the vice chair of the county's Disability Advisory Commission and also the chair of its Physical Access Subcommittee. The subcommittee has been involved with the Disability Compliance Office for the county, meeting with airport staff and the designers. We are supposed to get some responses on things that we requested. So far, what I've heard is that they are considering our request about the spectrum of lighting in the building. Stair striping, we're asking them to go beyond the requirement for interior steps. In other words, to have each step striped, and also on the escalators, and to have that in the federal yellow. They seem to be open to that. They haven't given us a final word on that. We are needing to, we've discussed different kind of wayfinding to get through that terminal. Through some pressure from the Board of Supervisors, I think they are considering looking at not only low technology but high technology, like talking signs, but also looking at tactile guides and visual color methods of wayfinding. We're still in the discussion on these things. Last month, the design of the exterior of the building, 95% of the design is complete. 75% of the interior design is complete. Many of the things from the blind and vision impaired perspective, they believe, still say that there's plenty of time that still can be included. The U.S. Access Board is possibly looking at this airport terminal as a model for a technical report, and we're doing some negotiations with the Access Board to see if they can come in, not to police or monitor the airport, but to see if they can be a resource, especially with new technologies, ideas. One thing that we've definitely been told, and it's not necessarily an issue directly for us, but in the building, there's going to be the main building, Terminal B, where you get your tickets and you get your luggage and so forth, and then you're going to go on a people mover, a little train, and take a 30-second ride to another building where the gates are. And that, a people mover, we've been told would be sort of like if you go through the Tampa airport, that it'll be like a solid glass wall that when the train comes up, the doors that are built into the glass wall will open, and then you would enter the car with a smooth transition. And then the reverse when you get the other end. There's going to be, some of us have had concerns about the challenge of if you've ever been to Dallas or O'Hare airports, is that you're at your gate for several hours and then you need to go to the restroom and to find a restroom on your own. The one thing that looks like now they have at ours will be a ratio of one unisex restroom for five gates per gates. So it'll be make it a lot easier in proximity to find one. And we're looking at ways of, you know, maybe textured floor versus contrasting carpet to find a pathway that would lead you to it. So that's some of the things I could just tell you right now.
Those
are called family restrooms. Well, in the code, it's unisex, but yeah, family assist and so forth, different places it varies. Any other questions for our two presenters, Aaron and Michael? If not, then I wish to thank them both for giving their time to come this morning and to give us an overview on the process for amending the building code. And if there's a website or anything that, again, that you might recommend people might go to, or who they should contact if they have any further questions?
Well, the state architect's website is dsa.ca.gov. Within the website, there's a link called accessibility, and then all our information is under that link. Yeah.
And the California Building Code is californiabuildingcode.gov. If you type that into Google, you'll get to the website, and you can look at who's on the commission, what's happening, you know, in the news of the commission, meeting schedules, et cetera.
Thank you, and I wish to thank Aaron and Michael for coming. Let's give them a hand. And that's the end of our meeting this morning. Thank you. Bye.